thousands of years. There were 1 million Palestinians living in Palestine at that time. There was collusion between political entities and world media and a complex and violent project to steal Palestine from Palestinians. And that project continues today to try to legitimize an illegitimate entity as Palestinians continue to resist the Zionists and their supporters. We're going to be taking a look at the 75 years since the Nakba. Today on this spotlight, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Fra Hughes, author and director, Palestine Aid Belfast, out of Belfast. And Charlotte Cates, international coordinator, Samadun Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network, out of Vancouver. Thank you both for being with me. Well, Fra, let's start off. I mean, if there's one entity more responsible for the existence of the Israeli regime, it would probably be the United Kingdom and its role in the Balfour Agreement and giving land to others which it didn't own. I mean, shouldn't London be held responsible? Are we likely to see compensation coming from the UK for Palestinians anytime?
Well, if we look at the history of the Zionist movement, it was around 1888 that they had their first Zionist Congress in Basel in Switzerland. And they were actually looking at Uganda and Madagascar, and also they were looking at Argentina as possible settlements, colonizations for the new project of Zionism. And like long before the Balfour Agreement in 1917, we had the Jewish National Fund, which I believe was a British-inspired institution, collecting money on behalf of the Zionist movement in order to buy land from the absentee Ottoman landlords. So we can go before Balfour to see a part being played by the British and by the Jewish National Fund. And yes, Balfour did promise the Zionist movement a place inside historic Palestine, while they encouraged the Palestinians to join Lawrence of Arabia and the British expeditionary forces in the Middle East to fight the Ottomans during the First World War. They promised the Arab peoples that they would have sovereignty and freedom, and that they would have their own governments and be self-determination states going forward. And they lied to the Arab people. They lied to the Palestinians. They had a secret agreement, the Balfour Agreement, between Lord Rothschild and Lord Balfour on behalf of the British government. So, you know, after the First World War, they then had the British and French mandate across the Middle East. So while promising people freedom and sovereignty, what they did was they actually replaced the Ottoman Empire with British and French spheres of influence, and they allowed the State of Israel to come into being. So Britain is wholly, not just partly, but wholly responsible for everything that has happened in historic Palestine. All the murders, I believe, that were carried out recently by the apartheid regime in Gaza. And I offer my condolences to those who were murdered and the many others, the hundreds of others who were injured. Britain is primarily responsible for everything that happened before 1948. And America is really responsible for everything that's happened subsequent to 1948. I don't think America, because let's not forget, it's American musicians that are murdering unarmed civilian Palestinians, men, women, and children. Okay. It's destroying their homes and their infrastructure. But I don't think the British will pay any reparations.
All right. Thank you, Fra. Well, Charlotte, I want to go back to the end of World War II, because what was said is that millions of Jews had been killed and that their homeland then should be Palestine. What logic could justify that the Germans killed millions of Jews, as they say, but then the Palestinians should be uprooted? I mean, how was it even justified? It's really baffling when we go back and look at this.
Because this is the logic of imperialism and colonialism. It's very clear when we look at the history of Western collaboration with the Nazi regime prior to World War II. It's very clear when we look at the history of Jews being denied entry to the United States and to Canada when they were fleeing Nazism. It's very clear that what happened in occupied Palestine was not a response to the crimes of the Nazi Holocaust. What happened in occupied Palestine was an attempt to use those crimes to instead enact a Western colonial project of destruction and division in the Arab world, and by using the Zionist movement in occupied Palestine. I mean, this was just like today, when we see the German state banning Palestinians from holding protests in Berlin to commemorate 75 years of Nakba and the ongoing struggle for liberation and return, this isn't something that's being done because of guilt over the crimes of the Holocaust. This is something that's being done as an active crime against the Palestinian people, not as any form of reparations to Jewish people. And it's time to put that lie to rest, because the reality is that the Israeli occupation is an imperialist project, it's a Zionist project, it's not a project that serves any form of justice or reparations for any people who have been oppressed in the world.
Well, Fra, I mean, what is it about the Zionists that sovereign countries such as the UK and the US also allowed Zionist terrorists to kill their own citizens to establish or expand the illegal entity of Israel? I mean, we look at the UK and the mandate, when the British mandate was ending, and how British troops were killed by Zionist terrorists. And of course, we know the USS Liberty, the American ship that was attacked by Zionists, and neither country did anything. I mean, why would they be so subordinate to this entity? Or is it because the entity is serving their interests, which is more important than the people's, their own people's rights?
Yes, if you separate this out into two different aspects, the first aspect is the death and murder of British troops by the Stern Gang, the Haganah, the Irgun, and others. British troops are just purely cannon fodder for the British government and their foreign policy. When we look at how many people died in the First World War in the trenches, they didn't care about sending tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of troops on ill-fated marches across no man's land to be gunned down by German gunners. So the British government cares nothing for British troops. The American state and the American government cares nothing for the sailors on that ship that was sunk, I believe, by Zionist aircraft whenever that was. I think it was the 67 war. Mm-hmm. So when you separate out the people from the governments and you separate out the interests from the elite political class that is in government and that is in hand with corporations and now the globalist corporations that want to take over the world, what we see mainly is that they will use even the death of their own troops in Palestine in 1948 as an excuse to leave in order to create the apartheid state. And America cares nothing for its soldiers who died in Vietnam, for the people who died in Afghanistan and Iraq. They're just cannon fodder. And we see Western governments and the mainstream media continue to define the war in the Middle East along parallels of Israel is this plucky little nation that has its back to the sea, facing a hostile environment of of Persian and Arab countries who want to destroy it. That is so far from reality that I'm amazed so many people believe it. But yes, it is foreign policy and the American, British, and I include the EU hegemonic machinations within the Middle East and West Asia. Ursula von der Leyen recently said that they made the desert bloom and on the 75th anniversary of the creation of the Israeli state. That tells you everything you need to know about the EU and the people that are running it.
Hmm. Interesting point. Well, Charlotte, let's talk about the role of the United Nations in trying to legitimize this illegitimate entity. I mean, if we look at 1 year after the Nakba, the Zionists had stolen 78% of Palestinian land. And then in May of 1949, Israel was recognized as an independent state by the United Nations. I mean, what does this say about the role of the United Nations in actually helping to establish and legitimize or try to legitimize the Israeli regime?
Well, it certainly also reflects that history, that these votes largely came before the great anti-colonial movements that won liberation in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And that's one reason why these votes were able to happen the way that they did, because these were essentially votes to legitimize the ongoing process of European colonialism in the Arab world and in the broader region, that essentially the crimes of the Western powers could be covered over by yet more colonial adventures, again, by confiscating the land and expropriating the land while expelling the indigenous people of occupied Palestine. And what we've seen from, 75 years ago until today is that the United Nations as an entity, despite the ongoing voices of many countries around the world, particularly the non-aligned movement, particularly Asian, African, Arab, certainly the Iran, Latin American countries, that what we continue to see is this domination and the use of the veto by the United States in order to prevent any kind of meaningful interaction by the United Nations in occupied Palestine. So today we do see the United Nations recognizing the Nakba. We see, special rapporteurs at the United Nations performing, meaningful inquiries into what's happening in occupied Palestine. But at the same time, the United Nations has never done what it needs to do, which is actually expel this occupying power, this illegitimate entity, from its body. If we're going to say that colonialism is contrary to international law, if we're going to say that apartheid is contrary to international law, then it's time that this so-called state, which is based solely on colonialism, apartheid, occupation, racism, and the dispossession of the indigenous people of the land, is not a legitimate state, is not a legitimate entity, and is something that only exists because it's propped up by $3.8 billion of weaponry given it every year by the United States.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Currently, there are 6 million Palestinians living in the diaspora who either have been expelled from their homes or are descendants of those who have been. 14 million Palestinians in total, many who are internally displaced. Either way, according to international law, expelling people from their homes or preventing them from returning is a war crime. So when do you think we're going to see Israeli regime leaders charged with war crimes? What will it take?
Well, it's never going to happen. If we agree that Israel is a white European colonization of Palestine, let us look to the past. Let us look to America, when white Europeans went to Canada, when they went to North America, when they went to Australia and New Zealand. They wiped out the indigenous population. They replaced the indigenous population. They said in North America, the only good Indian is a dead Indian. And I see parallels in Palestine that probably the right-wing Zionist Israelis who vote for the likes of Ben-Gvir probably think that the only good Palestinian is a dead Palestinian. You mentioned the UN. There are so many resolutions passed at the UN, even with American vetoes in place, that Israel has never accepted. Resolution 194, the right of return. You mentioned about the displacement of the ethnic population under an illegal occupation. That is in violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. The fact that Israel can murder 33 people in Gaza over 4 days with absolutely no recrimination from any of the Western leaders. In fact, we have the opposite. We have lip service. We have the UN and the EU. We have America and Britain saying we must put an end to the settlements. We must halt the settlement projects. We must step back from the abyss. We must bring people to the table. I know Egypt is permanently involved in the ceasefires that are developed between the Zionist regime and the resistance movements in Gaza. But even then, this all fits into a narrative that suits Israel. They can murder with impunity, and then whenever they need political fig leaf cover from politicians in the West, it is always there. The intention of Israel is to occupy the whole of Palestine, which you can see them doing day by day, incrementally, in the West Bank. And at some stage, they will have either a false flag or they will just, through economic starvation of the people of the West Bank, the occupied West Bank and Gaza, they will try and force the Palestinians to flee. There'd be no war crimes tribunal for the Israeli leaders. If we go back to Sharon, I mean, he was the butcher of Shabra and Shatia in Lebanon. These people have blood in their hands, they have hate in their hearts, and they have greed on their minds as they fill their own pockets with money and try to stay in power, as Netanyahu is trying to do for as long as possible. And I believe the attack, recent attack on Gaza, was to distract the Israeli population from their own internal troubles around these proposed judicial reforms. Mm-hmm. Netanyahu had them hiding in their bunkers so that they weren't at his front door.
Well, Charlotte, Fry was talking about the United Nations and the international community in general, and we saw a few hours ago Mahmoud Abbas addressing the UN on the Nakba Day. I found it quite interesting that nothing was even said about what just took place in Gaza, because we're talking about that the international community hasn't mentioned anything, whatever. I mean, even Mahmoud Abbas, when he was talking about the Nakba on the 75th anniversary, did not even mention that this major situation that has just taken place, and people, of course, are still suffering from the after effects. Let's talk about a little bit about that side of things and the whole Palestinian, because we know with certain aspects of Palestinian leadership, there has been some collusion helping, unfortunately, the Israeli regime. Your take.
Well, yeah, the Palestinian Authority was created as part of the Oslo process. It was actually created to take the Palestinian resistance and liberation movement and instead co-opt it and transform it into a mechanism of repression and security that would serve the security of the occupier rather than the security of the Palestinian people. This is why the basic part of the Oslo Accords is security coordination. That means pursuing the resistance, arresting resistance fighters and putting them in jail, and pursuing a revolving door policy where Palestinian prisoners are detained in Palestinian Authority jails only to be detained in Israeli jails, only to be detained in Palestinian Authority jails. And that's not because the PA is kind of a rogue human rights violator. This is the reason why the PA's security forces are funded by the United States, trained by Canada, trained by the European Union, is to serve as a mechanism of security for the occupation. And this has always been the case in colonial projects. There's always an attempt to find a local partner that, in order to serve kind of the interest of a narrow economic class that will benefit from having kind of advantages for capital investment or for profit, repress the majority of the Palestinian people. And so, you know, the Palestinian Authority's function is to repress Palestinian resistance. But what's been clear in this battle that's taken place over the past week in Gaza is that the Palestinian people are with the Palestinian resistance. And we see that every day in the West Bank. We see that in Nablus. We see that in Jenin. We see that increasingly in more areas throughout the West Bank, is that the PA of quote-unquote security control of these areas because the people are with the resistance. And we saw that in Gaza, where the masses of people celebrated the achievements of the resistance and, more deeply, the assassination of the martyrs of leaders of the resistance who have given so much in the struggle. But despite all of this, despite the creation of the PA, despite the path of Oslo, which we can see that 30 years later is a complete failure for the Palestinian people. It's very obvious, and the resistance continues to demonstrate on the grounds on a daily basis that the only alternative is resistance, revolution for liberation from the river to the sea, and that our responsibility, particularly those of us in Western countries in the imperial core that are providing the money, the arms, the diplomatic, political, military support to the occupation to continue these crimes, is to do everything that we can to shut down the war machine that's attacking the Palestinian people and to extend all of our support as a popular international cradle of the resistance to support those who are on the front lines, those who are defending not only the Palestinian people, but the entire region and all of humanity from the ravages of Zionism and imperialism. Mm.
Well, assassinating revolutionaries and those who resist Israeli terrorism have been a trait of the Zionist regime since its inception. Killing Palestinians who could lead their people's resistance is a modus operandi of the Zionists. But despite this, we see, as Charlotte has just mentioned, strong resistance leadership, more united leadership, and we see now more and more Palestinians actually following the resistance and praising the resistance. Your overall perspective of where this goes from now, because we're looking at, it seems, more solidarity and more effectiveness on the part of the resistance. Your take.
Yes, we can see from the likes of the Operation Room in Gaza, where you have several of the resistance groups coming together to act. Once upon a time, they would only have acted in their own interests, in their own narrow political field. But we can see more and more that if you kill someone in Hamas, or you kill someone in Islamic Jihad, or you kill someone in the PFLP, they are all seeing each other die as comrades and as martyrs. And it's bringing them together in a stronger, more unified bond.
Okay, stay with me, Fra, because I just want to get this last question into Charlotte. Sorry. But Charlotte, despite efforts trying to change the real narrative of Palestine online, there is growing awareness worldwide about Israeli terrorism. Do you think efforts from around the world will ultimately help Palestinians, or do you think the ultimate victory has to come from within Palestine and from the resistance itself?
The victory is going to come from the Palestinian people, from their resistance, from the Arab people, from the people of the region. But the struggle is Palestinian, Arab, and international in nature. And so it can be all of our victory if we all do everything that we can to strengthen the voice of the resistance, to provide the support that it needs, and to make sure that we are doing everything we can to stop our governments from their continuing complicity and participation in these crimes.
And I thank you both for a very interesting discussion. Fra Hughes, author and director at Palestine Aid Belfast, out of Belfast. Charlotte Cates, international coordinator, Samadun, Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network, out of Vancouver. And as always, we appreciate you being with us for another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Hope to see you right here next time. Goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the verses of chapter Nur, the 24th chapter of the Holy Quran, and different commentary points of these verses. So stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
سورة أنزلناها وفرضناها وأنزلنا فيها آيات بينات وأنزلنا فيها آيات بينات لعلكم تذكرون
This is a surah which we have sent down and made that within it obligatory and revealed therein verses of clear evidence that you might remember.
Dear listeners, this surah contains 64 verses and it has been sent down in Medina. We'll have a grand view of this surah, chapter Nur, before we get into the verses specifically. This surah is named as chapter Nur, and the reason why it has been named a Nur, or light, is its 35th verse, in which Allah has been introduced as Nur al-Samawati wal-Ard. Allahu Nur al-Samawati wal-Ard, the verse says, Allah is the light of the heavens and the earth. And since this holy surah has recommended all believers, and especially women, to be chaste, Islamic narrations do give much prominence to teaching and reciting this surah by women. I assume this surah can be considered as the surah of struggle against sexual defilements, the surah of virginity, because the main part of its commandments is about removing society from sexual defilements through different ways. And this aim has been set in several steps. For example, it is the statement of severe punishments of adulterers, and which is mentioned with full decisiveness in the second verse of this chapter. And this punishment, executing this severe prescribed punishment, is not an easy issue. And from the view of Islamic judicial scales, it has strict condition. If a man accuses his wife of adultery, the program li'an, must be carried out, and we will explain it later on, God willing. And if a person accuses someone of fornication, that person must present four witnesses. Even if someone accuses another person of fornication, but he cannot prove it in the court of Islamic judgment, he will himself be extremely punishment. So that no one can easily think of Islamic punishment of others by accusing them. Otherwise, that penalty will be imposed on himself. Then, this connection, the famous tradition known as ifk, and the accusation that was penned on one of the wives of Prophet ﷺ are mentioned. And the Holy Quran follows this issue so that it becomes completely clear that how great the sin of inventing a rumor about a virtuous person is.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
we
approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
In order to prevent this thought that Islam is only content with punishing wrongdoers, this surah mentions one of the important ways of preventing sexual defilements. It in details explains the issue of preventing men from gloating women and preventing women from casting amorous glances at men. Because one of the important factors of sexual deviations is non-veiling of women. Again, to prevent engaging in unchaste actions, the commandment of easy and simple marriage is issued in this surah, so that unlawfully satisfying sexual instinct will be struggled by its lawful way. Then, in this very surah, some of the rules of etiquette and principles of training offspring concerning parents are mentioned, stating that there are some times when husband and wife may want to be alone and isolated, so that issues must not enter their rooms without permission, for offspring may deviate intellectually thereby. For this end, it states some other rules of family life, though they may be unrelated to sexual matters. And some of the discussions that are about monotheism, resurrection, resignation to the command of Prophet ﷺ are mentioned before these discussions, because what support all practical and ethical programs are the very doctrinal issues and the belief in origin, resurrection, and a rightfulness of prophecy. And there will not be any branch, leaf, flower, and fruit if such a root does not exist. And meanwhile, in connection with discussions about faith and righteous deed, the establishment of the worldly government by the believers is stated, and some of the other Islam commandments are brought up. On the whole, this surah forms a comprehensive collection of Islamic thoughts and virtues. We'll start our discussion of the commentary points of this very surah in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets of this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
When faith begins.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Amid contradictory reports on the contents of the Egyptian-mediated ceasefire between Palestinian resistance group Islamic Jihad in the besieged Gaza Strip and Israel, Palestinian experts say that the Israeli regime is to abide by the agreement, at least for the time being, but they add that it's unclear how long the latest ceasefire will hold before the regime breaches it. Israel's seriousness will be determined to some extent by the length of the period of calm, they say.
Whether the Israelis are going to commit to this ceasefire, as we know that this is not the first time we have truce or ceasefire. It happened hundreds of times before, and all the time it was Israel who broke this kind of agreement, not just because the Palestinians do anything, but because the Israeli themselves and in this kind of regime, the colonial racist regime, it's used to that.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, during a cabinet meeting on Sunday, told his ministers that the Israeli military took out the entire leadership of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and by doing so fulfilled the goals of the so-called Shield and Arrow operation in perfect form. He also claimed that Tel Aviv had changed the equation and thwarted the entire top of the jihad movement. Meanwhile, Israel's far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir has demanded that targeted killing be carried out against Palestinian resistance leaders in the West Bank as well. He added that the last operation was good and important, but it must be continued.
The most important thing is that the Israeli regime failed to achieve any political goal, failed in restoring deterrence, failed in oppressing the resistance or creating a fraction between the Palestinians themselves or between different factions. Netanyahu has maybe temporarily succeeded in regaining his popularity. However, he will face his problems within days. This round is failure to Israel.
Analysts, meanwhile, say one of the reasons Netanyahu agreed to the ceasefire is Thursday's controversial flag march that is held every year by the Israelis to mark the occupation of East Al-Quds in 1967 Six-Day War. This annual event has prompted fightings in past years as the Israeli regime insisted not to reroute the flag march away from the Muslim quarter of Al-Quds. Palestinians wonder whether the Israeli policies and killings in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds would affect in a way or another the inevitability of the ceasefire, mainly after Ben-Gvir's call to assassinate resistance leaders in the West Bank. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
From the disgrace of the Nakba to today's resistance. The 75th anniversary of the occupation of Palestine is a time to reflect on the long way the oppressed nation of Palestine has come in its struggle for freedom, while shedding light on the numerous instances of human rights violations committed by Israel in the Palestinian territories.
There are over 1,000 Palestinians currently jailed in administrative detention with no charge or no trial under a Zionist regime that can indefinitely extend their detention, leaving them jailed with no charge or no trial for years on end.
The issue of Palestine is the most important issue in the Muslim world, and Nakba is an occasion for all of us to condemn the atrocities against Palestinians. Resistance is the only way to liberate Palestine.
The Nakba has greatly influenced Palestinian culture, and now a new generation of Palestinians is ready to make the ultimate sacrifice in the fight for freedom.
Resistance has paid off. After years of resistance, now we have reached a point where there is no talk about the Greater Israel Project. That image of an invincible army has been shattered.
It's true that the Israeli regime has tried to create the impression that it's strong. We all know that they have the support of world powers. But today, the regime is facing lots of domestic problems. That's mainly the reason for the escalation of raids and attacks in the occupied territories and the Gaza Strip. It's a way to deviate attention from its internal issues. But the international community is now more aware than before.
Today, the word Nakba and what it stands for is known to all who are preoccupied by the Palestinian cause.
This year on May 15th, the United Nations will be holding a high-level special meeting to mark the 75th anniversary of the Nakba. This is the first time that the international body is marking the date, recognizing the historic injustice suffered by the Palestinian people. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
It was a gathering of defiance and hope, a chance for pro-Palestinian organizations and supporters to remind the international community they have not forgotten about justice for Palestine. 75 years on from the catastrophe, there was an urgent message for the world.
Today, and our first message is one of solidarity to the Palestinian people, those across historic Palestine from the river to the sea, those in the diaspora. The Palestinians expelled in 1948 and their descendants, who today are marking what happened in 1948, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, the destruction of more than 500 Palestinian villages, but are also marking the Nakba not as a moment rooted in the past, but an ongoing process of colonization, a dispossession and oppression.
Ongoing Israeli aggression and injustices mean the Nakba is not simply a historic moment, but one that demands an immediate response to the current situation.
The Nakba is ongoing, and we have seen the latest threads in that tapestry of the Nakba woven in Gaza, once again. Suffering the raining of Israeli bombs.
The international community continues to fail the Palestinians, not just for their role in the facilitation of the ethnic cleansing and displacement of the people, but for their continued political blind eye, a blind eye that allows Israel to act with impunity in its subjugation and oppression of Palestinians day in, day out.
Britain's role in not just pushing through the Balfour Agreement, but London's current position as a staunch ally of Tel Aviv makes the demands of the marchers all the more pressing.
What we're asking for as a British public is sanction Israel. We're asking for international law to be upheld. If any other country was breaking this many laws this frequently on an international level, sanctions would be placed upon them without doubt. So we're asking for level playing field here, international law to be applied to Israel, sanction Israel now. The Nakba isn't a historical fact. It's a fact that's going on right now.
We want to see an end to UK-Israeli weapons trade going both directions, actually. It's not just a one-way street. We want to see an end to that. And we want to really call our government to account for its complicity, not only in the arms trade and so on, but the continuing repression within Gaza and within the occupied territories. Really, 75 years is way too long. It's 75 years too long. And we want to see the restoration of freedom and liberty to the Palestinian peoples, to their lands and to their state.
As Palestinians continue to resist the occupation with every resource available to them, those demonstrating are keen to show the spirit of solidarity across the globe remains steadfast. Amina Taylor, London.
Thousands marched in Paris to commemorate 75 years since the Palestinian Nakba,
which means catastrophe. The imperialist slaughter and theft by Israelis on a horrific scale in 1948. To achieve their goal of conquering Palestine, Israelis immediately turned 800,000 Palestinians into homeless refugees, used ethnic cleansing to destroy over 400 villages, and massacred over 15,000 people. Since then, Israelis have forcibly displaced a stunning 14 million Palestinians, jailed over 1 million people, and launched an average of 10 police raids every single day. The cruelty Israel has shown towards Palestinians for 75 years has been unending, and the path to justice seems like a long road.
Firstly, it means the end of occupation, because you can always imagine a reconciliation between the rapist and its victim. But this can never happen during the rape. The rape has to cease. And this is the first step.
Even though Muslims outnumber Jews in France by 15-1, their support of Palestine is not democratically reflected. Paris has long considered itself as Europe's primary diplomat on the world stage, but many say they do nothing to rein in Israel's daily atrocities and falsely label Palestinian supporters as being against Judaism and Jews.
To label people who defend Palestinians as anti-Semites is a well-known strategy from the Zionist lobby, from the government of Israel, in order to suppress the struggle for sovereignty in Palestine, the human rights in Palestine. Even human rights organizations in Israel are labeled as anti-Semite for defending Palestinian rights and exposing Israeli crimes. This kind of label we cannot accept.
Rarely admitted in the Western media, but common knowledge globally, Israel has turned Gaza into the world's largest prison, where hundreds of Palestinians are murdered by Israelis each year for their land, homes, and beliefs. Israel is currently waging one of its nearly annual wars on Gaza and have killed dozens and wounded over 150 people in the past several days. As many Palestinians remind, the Nakba is ongoing, even if the West would like to ignore it. On May 15th, the United Nations will, for the first time ever, commemorate the massacre, theft, and genocide of 75 years ago. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Only weeks after he said the UK economy might have turned a corner, this announcement by the Bank of England's governor.
But let me be clear, inflation remains too high, and it's our job to get it all the way down to the 2% target and have it stay there. And this is why today we've increased bank rate by 0.25 percentage points to 4.5%.
Since it took measures to tackle the pace of price rises in the UK, the bank has now raised interest rates multiple times, raising questions among economists such as Professor Keith Pilbeam about the efficacy of the move.
Well, today's interest rate rise is just another indication of the failure of the Bank of England to do its job earlier. And had it raised interest rates well before it started raising them and raised them more substantially, we probably wouldn't be headed to even higher rates down the road, and certainly inflation would have been brought back under control.
The rate rise will have consequences, economists say, for other sectors of the economy, such as the housing market, where 2.5 million Britons will soon have to renew their home loans at higher interest rates. For months, increases in wholesale energy prices caused by self-imposed sanctions over the war in Ukraine were blamed for the unbridled inflation here. Energy prices have since eased, but inflation hasn't.
Well, what did Rishi Sunak do when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer? He borrowed well over £300 billion, increasing the fiscal deficit to 15% of GDP. How was that financed? It wasn't financed through tax rises. It wasn't financed through some sort of government cuts or anything like that. It was financed purely by printing of money by the Bank of England. £300 billion in one go, raising the UK money supply from £600 billion to £900 billion in the space of 1 year.
Rampant inflation has seen grocery prices shoot up by up to 20%. The demand for food banks doubled compared to 5 years ago, and months of public sector strikes for pay rises.
This is the 12th consecutive interest rate rise in less than 2 years, with the Bank of England leaving the door open for more hikes in the coming months. The question now is, when will the bank hit the pause button? Saeed Pourreza, London.
Italy's top officials reiterated Rome's full support for Kiev during Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's one-day visit to the Italian capital. On Saturday, meetings between Zelensky and Italy's President Sergio Mattarella and Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni took place amid heightened security measures across the city centre, including a no-fly zone ordered for Rome's skies and police snipers strategically placed on high buildings. Zelensky received pledges of open-ended continued military and financial support by Italy's government.
We are betting on Ukraine's victory. I reiterated to my friend Volodymyr Zelensky that Italy will continue to back his country for as long as necessary. Also, we acknowledge and support Kyiv's European Union ambitions.
Since the war began 15 months ago, Italy has provided over 1 billion euros in financial and military aid, including the costly SAMP-T air defense system, which has for itself a value of around 800 million euros. This, despite polls have been showing for about a year that more than half of the Italians are against sending weapons to Kyiv, and tens of anti-war protests have been staged across the country. After meeting Italy's top officials, Zelensky held talks with Pope Francis. The Holy See has repeatedly offered its readiness to act as a peacemaker in the conflict in Russia and Ukraine. According to some analysts, the Vatican taking the role of mediator is an option that upsets chancelleries of many Western states.
Western chancelleries' opposition to the Vatican working for peace in Ukraine is paradoxical and contradictory. Paradoxical because a ceasefire would be beneficial for all the parties involved, and contradictory because key Chinese diplomats will start touring Europe on Monday. And my feeling is that Western governments will be more inclined to accept China's mediation on the Ukraine crisis rather than that of Pope Francis.
The Vatican is reportedly involved in a behind-the-scenes peace mission, but so far no details have been disclosed. Neither Russia nor Ukraine has confirmed such an initiative. Earlier this week, Pope Francis met with Russia's outgoing ambassador to the Vatican, Alexander Avdeyev. Some Italian media have reported that the envoy may have been given a letter for Russian President Vladimir Putin. Max Civili, Rome.
Hundreds of people attended a memorial service for slain Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. Abu Akleh held an American passport and worked for the Al Jazeera TV network. She was killed by an Israeli sniper on May 11, 2022, while she was covering an Israeli raid in the West Bank city of Jenin. Footage captured moments after she was shot shows her motionless body with another Palestinian reporter being seen next to her. Both are wearing easily recognizable press vests and blue helmets. Since her killing, Abu Akleh has been hugely remembered by Palestinians for her dynamism and courage to cover Israeli crimes. The road where her office was located is now named Shireen Abu Akleh Street.
Every morning we pass by her office to say good morning, Shireen. All our colleagues, including myself, who accompanied her when she was martyred, still think that she is on vacation and will be back to the office.
Shortly after her death, the U.S. government said evidence showed Abu Akleh was killed by an Israeli bullet. But ironically, Washington claimed that it had seen no evidence pointing to her killing being intentional, a line that has also been used by the Israeli regime. Washington also promised an investigation to find out the truth, but a year of U.S. inaction has prompted Palestinians to take the matter into their own hands.
The case has been submitted to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. We're still working to pressure on the Attorney General and the court itself to act and to take a stand in this regard, either by announcing the creation of an official independent international investigation committee or by simply announcing his position.
Abu Akleh was not the first journalist to be killed by the Israeli regime. A report by the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate published in 2023 shows Israel has murdered more than 50 Palestinian journalists in the past 22 years, but the regime has never taken responsibility for any of those killings. Many fear that Israel's impunity only means more Palestinian journalists will be killed in the future.
Israel wants to silence the free speech and the voice of the press, as well as the truth which convey the atrociousness of the Israeli occupation and its crimes.
Even Western politicians who are staunch supporters of Israel are now calling for an independent and thorough probe into the Palestinian journalist's murder. But after so many calls and too many letdowns, many are now questioning whether the situation would have been different if Abu Akleh had not been Arab or Palestinian.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware. The hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
May 13, 1984. Place, Husseiniyah Jamaran, Tehran. Subject, Methods of Islamic Invitation. In Islam, all the works one has been invited to carries devotional aspect, even working in factories, on the farm, at a school, carries the connotation of act of worship in the context of Islamic expediency. Islamic expediencies, as prescribed by the Holy Quran, were not observed because they found it in contrast to their desires for powers. From the beginning, what they saw in the Quran running counter to their interest, they interpreted the Quran to comply with their liking. Because they could not make any changes in the Quran itself, they interpreted crookedly.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. The late Imam Khomeini recommended the faithful people to purify their intentions, making their deeds more pure, and expelling love of oneself. Imam sheds light on the matter through his theological works as following. If you purify your intentions, recitify your deeds, expel love of self and position from your hearts, a high station will be prepared for you. The whole world and what exists will be prepared for you. The whole world and what exists in it, along with its superfactual aspects, is not worth even a cent by comparison to the station prepared for the righteous servants of Allah. Try to achieve this lofty station. The difference between my action and your actions, dear brothers and sisters, goes back to intention. The reality, the soul, the spirit of every action that we do is actually the intention. Why are we doing this action? There are two teachers with one classroom. The first teacher punishes the entire classroom out of envy, out of hatred towards the students. The second teacher punishes the entire classroom for their own good. The teacher is seeing that they need to be punished so they could be well, so they could respect the teacher, for example, or to have a better upbringing or better education. The difference between the two is the intention from each teacher. The first one is wicked and evil. The second one is good and has pure intentions to it. Therefore, the second one is accepted and should be thanked for, should be grateful for. The first one should be rebuked and criticized. If our attentions were worldly, then other than the